The hospital that has been hit a number of times, is it still functioning? Yeah. Is it the only hospital in Severodonetsk?
There's two. There's a military hospital. They keep hitting the civilian hospital. You know, they know it's a big building. I mean, there's no mistakes here. You know, there's drones flying. Yesterday, I saw a unit of Ukrainians shooting down a drone. I heard a buzzing in the air. You know, that's a drone. And Ukrainians shot it out of the air. I was there. So they know exactly what they're doing. I mean, they could level this town, and they're not doing that, but 1%. So every building in the city has its windows have been broken. Almost every block, there's been an explosion. A rocket or artillery or mortar round has landed. You know, it's not level, but this is like, you know, slow motion. You know, the mass destruction of the city.
Did we lose Billy? Billy, if you're speaking, we don't hear you. After that, we lost contact with independent journalist Billy Nesson, who's in the Ukrainian city of Severodonetsk, right up against the Russian lines under constant shelling. It's the easternmost city still held by Ukrainian forces after almost 3 months of war. We later did hear from him yesterday that he was okay, at least for now. We've tried to reach him today, and we haven't been able to reach him yet. That does it for today's show. Special thanks to Renee Feltz and Hani Massoud. Very happy birthday.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland.
Museums, no one sees them. Y'all killed 130 million Native Americans and 100 million Africans in the slave trade. Do you think Hitler held the title?
No small feat, but with smallpox, measles, cholera, brutality, mercantilism, and massacres, there's nothing good old American know-how can do. So move over, Hitler. Roll over, King Leopold, Chairman Mao, Comrade Stalin, Pol Pot, pole vault over the Valley of Death. The Black Death itself didn't take that many down. White Death wears the hate crown.
The Holocaust exists. You left a couple off your list. We've got to struggle to resist your sense of tally of the victims.
The British Raj said, no more coffee, drink tea. I take it sweet with pure white sugar and a dash of the Queen's pure white. We say genocide, you say plenty of blame on both sides. Which side are you on? One side tried to run and hide. The other side got fruitful and multiplied.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the right corner, there are armed armies.
On the left, the coroner left the unarmed, disemboweled, nameless heaps of carcasses.
They died and you said thank you on Thanksgiving.
There's barely anyone left to say thanks to. You killed so many of them.
CGI Johnny Depp's can play them all in the movie and you'll thank him. And wear his savior colonialism savage cologne.
The smell of napalm in the morning.
Attack Iraq, attack Iran, Yemen and Afghanistan. It's not just Nazis and the Klan denying Holocaust and bloodbaths.
We'd like to order a round of museums for the indigenous people killed in Guatemala, the uncountable millions in the Congo, Haitians, Armenians, Yemenis, Vietnamese, Lao, Cambodians, Romani, Sudanese, Kashmiris. I want you to pay Uncle Sam and stop waving your little finger at us.
We aren't going to fight on the genocide side anymore. No more Holocaust museums until every statue is down of slave owners and Indian killers.
No more Middle Passages, no more Holocaust, no more Nakbas,
no more wars on drugs. No more wars on the poor. No more wars on crime. No more wars on Iran. Iraq. Iran again. Iraq again. Iran again.
No more prisons. No more white supremacist presidents. No more white supremacist landlords. No more borders. Just following orders. Just supporting the troops. Just making America great. The greatest of all time. And genocide.
All right, that's a way to start a show, huh? Okay, this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I am your host, Paul Roland, be with you for the next hour. I got some squeaks going on here. I'm not sure what that is. we'll try to figure that out. I've got a guest coming up in maybe 10 minutes or so, Scott Nakagawa. I will introduce him at that time. I just want to tell you a little bit about that band, which I guess I'm kind of embarrassed to say I just came across myself. Here, let me just turn this mic down and move the mic. Maybe that'll help. I got some feedback going, maybe. Well, we'll just go on. I don't know if that's feedback from my headphones or what. Anyway, so the band you heard, Free Radicals, is from Houston. I just heard about them, but they've been around about 25 years. A Houston collective that's released 9 albums worth of, I'm just reading from a review here, brash, unfiltered musical mayhem encapsulating the essence of their city's superlative diversity with a sound that fuses funk, jazz, ska, reggae, klezmer, hip-hop, and countless other styles the world across. In April, they released White Power Outage, Volume 2. I love that title. A 25-track follow-up to a 2020 record release in defiance of the racist hate that continues to fester at the core of Western ideology. So, that's Free Radicals. So, Ty, do you hear feedback on your end? Okay, well, we'll just proceed here. I was talking to my board operator, Ty, there. Okay, I've got an announcement to make. This Friday, there will be another Portland climate strike. That'll be at 11 a.m. at Portland City Hall down on Southwest 4th. And then a march following at noon from City Hall to Revolution Hall. That's there on Southeast Stark between 12th and 14th. And then from 2 to 8 p.m., a climate festival with live performances by Marisa Anderson, Rebel Wise, which includes Mike Crenshaw and Quincy Davis, a group called Teeth, Chainsaw Girl, and much, much more. You can, I'm sure, find that on Facebook. That's the Portland Climate Strike and the Portland Climate Festival coming up this Friday. Check that out for sure. Too few opportunities to get together and protest, get together and celebrate after these 2+ years of pandemic. So, celebrating and protesting together outside, what could be better? And what a more crucial issue facing us as the climate crisis, which I've talked about considerably on this show. Title for my show, a bit of an ambitious title, Mass Shooters and Their Enablers, the Demographic Shift and the Death Spiral of White Supremacy, with Scott Nakagawa, who's a 42-year veteran of social and economic justice advocacy and has served as an organizer, political strategist, and social movement analyst in the struggle against authoritarianism and for equitable and inclusive democracy since 1988. He serves as co-director of the 22nd Century Initiative, a national strategy and action center that is preserving and expanding the potential for inclusive, people-centered democracy in the U.S. by building the field of resistance to authoritarian ideas and movements. He is a past Open Society Foundation's fellow and senior fellow at Nationalism, Authoritarianism, and Race of Race Forward, the Center for Racial Justice Innovation. He's also a writer whose essays on authoritarianism and resistance can be found online in the Anti-Authoritarian Playbook. And there's a link to that on my program page at kbo.fm. Mentioning our program page, kbo.fm, that's where you can go to support this station and this kind of programming that you get so few places on the spectrum with so many stations. You know, if you flip through all the stations there are, there's dozens and dozens of them, but I find it personally kind of dreary, the absolute repetitiveness, banality, and inanity. that you get, which is probably why a lot of young people have kind of abandoned terrestrial radio and gone to, you know, you can pick their own stuff to listen to on their devices. And not just young people. Young and old alike have access to modern technology and things like podcasts. Well, we have podcasts too at KBOO.FM, podcasts of all our program and some programs that actually don't go out over the air. And we have a lot of dedicated, really skilled people making that programming happening. And, you know, we're trying to keep it live, keep it alive, keep it fresh. And we've been doing it for 53 years or so now. And, you know, it's a constant struggle to keep up with the times, to keep things fresh, to keep things, you know, things, keep ourselves critical and, you know, conscious of what's going on in the world and contesting the dominant narratives that are happening. So if you appreciate that, and I know you do because you're listening to this show, we really want you to go to KBOO.FM and click on the donate button right now. You can also go text KBOO to 44321 on your mobile device. 44321, that's the way to do it. You can also mail us your check to KBOO at Southeast at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue here in Portland, Oregon at 97214. It is so crucial and so important in these times that we keep places like KBOO alive and thriving. And as we come out of the pandemic, I know we heard the folk show live from the studio this morning. That was really good to hear. I think we're slowly going to be shifting back unless, you know, we have another big wave of some COVID sub-variant, which is unfortunately possible and is actually kind of happening. But I hope you all are staying safe and doing what you can to keep that from happening. But I do think we are kind of be shifting. So, you know, we're going to kind of waken up and come back together here at KBOO like a we are other places, and yeah, to ensure a good transition, and there are a lot of the equipment upgrades we need, and there are a lot of staff hires that we're in the midst of. We need your support. We really, really need your support. So please click on KBOO.FM, go click on the donate button there, or text 44321. Text KBOO to 44321. With that, it looks like we do have our guest on the air who I've already introduced. Hello, Scott.
Hello.
It's so good to hear you.
Good to hear you, too. It's been such a long time, Paul.
Yeah, I think we passed each other just briefly at a political meeting a few years ago now, and that was the only time I've seen you. I think I may have seen you in the studio once even. But anyway, we actually crossed paths kind of early in your journey as a social and economic justice advocate and activist. And maybe we could start out. I kind of wanted to see if you had anything to say about the, you know, quickly about the primaries. But maybe you could just start out by, you know, talk us a little bit about your own history, how you got into the kind of work you do.
Okay, well, it's a long and complicated story that I'll try to keep short, but I have been a service provider and community advocate, or was for a long time, starting around 1980 until around 1986, 87. And around that time, I started to pivot to dealing with what appeared to be the rise of kind of fascistic right-wing movement in the United States, and particularly in the Northwest, where they were very, very active. And around 1988, when a young man named Mulugeta Sarah, an Ethiopian immigrant to Portland, was murdered by members of Eastside White Pride, a Portland-based white supremacist group, I got active in trying to understand the problem and oppose it, and eventually fell in with a group of people who formed an organization in Portland called the Coalition for Human Dignity. So I staffed that group for a few years before then moving on to work on the campaign staff of something many people will remember called the No on Nine campaign, which opposed an Oregon Citizens Alliance sponsored anti-LGBTQ ballot measure that was attempting to changed the Oregon Constitution to have LGBTQ people deemed abnormal, wrong, unnatural, and perverse. And so, you know, out of that odd history in Oregon, I was recruited to work at the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, leading a program called Fight the Right, and since then have been kind of on that path in a variety of different forms. Right now, I'm the director, as I'm sure you pointed out, of something called the 22nd Century Initiative, the National Action and Strategy Hub in the budding movement to oppose authoritarianism and white nationalism. So, yeah, that's kind of my story. That's the good part, anyway. I try not to tell the bad parts.
Well, you know, if there's anything from that that would inform our discussion, feel free to bring anything up that you want to. Given that history, it's no surprise that I'm talking to you about what we're going to be talking about today. You I'm sure could have foreseen, unfortunately, more than a lot of other people from your perspective, the continued and in some ways increased rise of role of white supremacy and white supremacist violence in our society. Obviously, Trump had a lot to do with it, but it's as our song that you probably didn't hear from the group Free Radicals, other genocide, other Holocausts pointed out, there's a deep, deep history of white supremacist violence in this culture, in this society that still goes unfortunately undealt with. So yeah, what's your impressions given your long history and what happened the other day in Buffalo and the long string of similar incidents?
Well, you know, many of us have been watching this problem develop over a long time. And, you know, when I reference that, you know, I'm telling the good part of the history, not the bad part, what I really mean by that is, you know, when you talk to somebody like me, I'm 61 years old, and I've been in this fight for a really long time, about, you know, what's happening on the right, you have to keep in mind that we've been predicting, but not knowing what to do about it effectively or having the resources to do anything effective about it for a very long time now. And so, you know, you should take what I say with a grain of salt and recognize that I have more mistakes to learn from than victories. You know, I think that over the trajectory, over those years, one of the things we've learned is that you have to invest in vigilance at all times. We have gone through so many waves of backlash, such as we are in right now. And in each of those moments when backlash movements develop, we find ourselves with our pants down, you know, completely unprepared, not having made the long-term investments we need to in order to be positioned to fight effectively at those times. And, you know, my own personal history is real evidence of that. You know, in the early part of that struggle around the late 80s and early 90s, there was, relatively speaking, robust funding from philanthropy, for instance, and a lot of interest from the public in dealing with the right. And then by the mid-90s and late 90s, that started to fall off. And in the aughts, the time when the far right was building its ranks really rapidly underground, the funding fell off almost entirely. And in fact, the appetite for even hearing about what was happening on the right grew so small that those of us who were being vigilant and trying to inform the public of the threat we were facing basically were reduced to having to, you know, be in a situation where you can see the kitchen's on fire, but you don't want to appear alarmist because people don't want to hear that kind of message. And so, you know, we're basically walking around saying, I smell smoke, you know. And so, you know, it's just not having that kind of infrastructure in place, not having that kind of investment in vigilance is something that we're paying for now and paying for dearly.
Mm-hmm. So obviously, there is a deep history to this that we need to take into account, and a lot of, you know, the headlines shout another mass shooter, another right-wing violent attack, another attack on people of color. But interestingly, you know, I said mass shooters, they're enablers, and I'm sure I'd like to get your take on that, because there's many, many, many enablers. including, you know, the gun industry, the politicians who, you know, not just on the Republican side, et cetera, et cetera. But it seems to me maybe an opportunity now. I don't know. I guess we always say that. Maybe we always have to, you know, try to seize on every horrible incident to make something happen. But, you know, there's a pushback now more on Tucker Carlson, who is obviously not the main culprit in this, but he's a major force, a really, really major force. And, you know, maybe there will be some sort of, I don't know, obviously Fox News is pretty unfazable, untouchable at this point. But yeah, talk about, you know, just what comes up for you when I say mass shooters and their enablers.
Well, you know, I think that what we need to understand here is that we're in a fight with oligarchs, with right-wing oligarchs. It's easy enough to think of ourselves as primarily being at battle with groups like the Proud Boys. But, you know, there are those who are investing in right-wing movements and who have kind of been the architects of the right-wing takeover of the Republican Party, who we too often forget. You know, for right-wing oligarchs, democracy is the ultimate form of wealth and power limitation. And so they want it gone. And what they're doing is investing in all manner of different kinds of things in order to create a context in which democracy is no longer viable. So one of the things that they've done, for example, is to invest in demonization of many different groups of people. By creating demons, what they're doing is making pluralism really unappealing to us, because you can't really go to the table and negotiate around politics with demons, right? With magical beings who are out to kill you or to destroy you, or to, in this case, what the popular belief is that Tucker Carlson has been promoting, replace you, right? There's that replacement theory that Fox has been pushing. And so I think that that's really important to keep in mind, that from the bottom up, the right looks like one thing, but from the top down, certainly it's a movement of oligarchs who are trying to dismantle liberal democracies in order to make way for wealth and power consolidation of a sort that we've never seen. The other thing I think to keep in mind is that, you know, that movement of oligarchs was facilitated by Republican Party polarization around the 60s and 70s, and in particular in reaction to the civil rights movement. So they basically saw the writing on the wall at that point in time. They were the Republicans at the time were the minority party in the United States and had been for a long time. And so they decided that the only way to stop being the minority was to polarize people really extremely. And they took advantage of, you know, kind of fear-driven politics, particularly as articulated by Barry Goldwater, against the civil rights movement, and started investing in a white racial mobilization that we are now seeing manifested in the form of these white nationalist groups and movements. And, you know, by doing that, basically they broke a long consensus. At the time, you know, split ticket voting was really commonplace. And, you know, people often talk about the civility in Congress and whatnot. Well, that was all contingent on the two parties being far too alike. You know, American voters didn't really have any options. And so one cycle, Richard Nixon may appear appealing, and in the next cycle, Jimmy Carter may appear appealing, you know, just based on really small differences. The Republicans decided there needed to be big differences in order to make room for their agenda, and so this is the investment they made. They invested in building an evangelical right-wing faction through attacking abortion rights and LGBTQ rights, et cetera, and then they have invested in white racial mobilization. And at this point, those mobilizations have taken over the party. And so, you know, it's always the case that, you know, you don't have to be a fascist to behave like one as a politician. But if you behave like one, you will eventually be trapped by the, you know, kind of context you yourself are creating. And that appears to have happened to Republican elites in the U.S. And the party is in some crisis. So all of those things, I think, are worth consideration. You know, basically, you know, at the end of the Cold War, you know, the kind of ideas, old-fashioned ideas about liberalism and, of course, communism were no longer viable as kind of political leverage points in global politics. And people often, many people believed that liberalism was going to win the day. But the reality is that, you know, we are facing what we're facing now because we're in a period of paradigm shift. And in that paradigm shift around governance and politics, only one side had, kind of plan, right? The right side had a plan. And their plan was to promote illiberalism and to dismantle democracy. What we on the left need to do is come up with a plan. We need a long-term vision. We need to understand what are we going to be and what can we achieve in the post-liberal future. And we have made very little investment of that kind. And the conversations are all really just beginning now.
It'd be really interesting to get your take on, speaking of having the primaries yesterday, on Democracy Now, they talked about, you know, some certain sort of wins on the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And I think you would probably have a lot to say about how that sort of plays into this long-term vision. But before we get there, if that's where you want to go, let's talk about the second part of this, of the title of my show, the demographic shift. You already brought up this whole replacement mm-hmm. theory. I just want to mm-hmm. Preliminary, and you can go off on this, but you know, it just struck me. It's so obvious to anybody who thinks about this, but you know, they're obviously having to suppress the real replacement that happened. It's the massive demographic boom of European Americans who came here, and mm-hmm. And you know, the whole Manifest Destiny, the takeover of the continent, and the various forms of eliminating, marginalizing, suppressing the indigenous population, and then the original great replacement fear of the population increase of the freed slaves, which led to a whole century of post-slavery, Jim Crowism, et cetera. Anyway, so obviously that's what the origins of this great replacement is sort of a, I guess in some ways, a fear of revenge, the revenge of the oppressed peoples. And then just to cut to the reason, there really is a demographic shift that's been going on for decades, which is just sort of a slow, I guess I would say almost natural, browning of the population, some immigration, intermarriage, just a glacial shift that's going on that does have the right wing really scared and leads to the radicalization of people like the Buffalo mass shooter. I know that's a lot to chew on, but go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's a lot to chew on, but it all makes sense to me. You know, you're right that there have been a number of different kinds of major shifts in demography in the United States and that we're in the midst of one now. The browning of the U.S., the browning of the globe, really, is something that the right has been reacting to. But we should keep in mind that people are not just simply naturally reacting to a change that they're seeing that feels threatening to them. The change is happening, and people are reacting to it in parts of the country where there's no immediate evidence. You know what I mean? In parts of the country that are not growing browner, people are equally, if not more, afraid of this change. And so we have to ask ourselves, who's making them afraid, right? People like Tucker Carlson, Fox News, OAN, et cetera, are the people who are making them afraid of this change. And so that, you know, you could have a campaign against, immigrants in Montana with the threat that they would steal the apple harvest from Montana workers when they're like five people, you know what I mean? So just keep that in mind. But we are in the midst of demographic change that has become a lever of fear to the right. And we should always remember that the right actually is more afraid of us than we are of them, which is a real problem because they're the ones who represent the real threat far more than we do.
And they got the guns.
And they got the guns, yeah. The guns, the training, the whole thing. But you know, the racial demographic shift that we're in is often distracts us from another kind of demographic change that I think we need to pay attention to, which is that, at least according to the conservative political theorist Norman Ornstein, by 2040 or so, 70% of Americans will live in 15 states. That means only 30% will choose 70 senators and, of course, control the Electoral College. And that 30% will be older, whiter, more rural, more male than the 70%, right? As Ornstein puts it, unsettling to say the least, because this opens up a path for minority rule that the GOP and other right-wing groups are actively exploiting. So, you know, the promise of demographic change is limited by that and many other factors, including the emergence of reactionary movements in the Asian American community and perhaps one in the Latino community, and then, kind of general movement to the right of males, male voters, men. And so we should just keep all of that stuff in mind simultaneously. Demographic change of the racial kind might not give us all the benefits we want, but domestic migration patterns dictate that regardless, the right has a really big advantage here.
Mm-hmm. Let me just reintroduce the program, which is Wednesday Talk Radio on the station KBOO Community Radio. We are in our spring membership drive. Just a quick reminder about that. I'll talk a little more a little bit further on. But you can go to kboo.fm to support this kind of programming, support having a guest on like Scott Nakagawa with his 42 years of experience, him and many others that we present to you on a day-by-day, week-by-week, month-by-month basis. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate, or you can text 44321, text KBOO to 44321 on your mobile device. Scott is a 42-year veteran, as I said, of social and economic justice advocacy. He served as an organizer, political strategist, and social movement analyst in the struggle against authoritarianism and for equitable and inclusive democracy since 1988, which, if you heard from the outset, he outlined some of his history, going back to the killing of Mulugeta Sarah, the Ethiopian immigrant, which was just one of many foreshadowings of what is a long line of such right-wing racist violence. And we're talking about the Buffalo mass shooter, one in a long line of these mass shooters who really, they seem to be, you know, this whole idea of radicalization. I guess for our generation, the internet is something that we've kind of had to grapple with as a new reality in terms of social, you know, the social phenomena and in terms of organizing, and it creates a whole new layer of problems because there's these people who, you know, they at one point they would, if they were loners, they would have just been loners alone. And, you know, trying to, whatever, dealing with their social problems, their, you know, but not necessarily even finding out about the kind of ideologies. I mean, that's actually something I just thought about. I mean, the kind of radicalization that was happening back at the time with some of the right-wing groups, I mean, it had to be kind of like meeting someone personally or getting handed a leaflet somewhere, you know, at a punk rock show or something where the skinheads were trying to make the racist skinheads were trying to make inroads. But yeah, I mean, that's such a, or, you know, but then again, there is a right there on Fox News, there's Tucker Carlson. So I guess it's not that difficult to find.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, you know, all around us. And, you know, it's easy for people to fall prey to the idea that the problem is polarization, right? We hear a lot of that conversation, that social identity polarization is the chief problem, and it certainly looks like that from the bottom up, but it's a symptom, it's an effect of a much bigger problem. Now, you know, effects, symptoms can kill you, and so we shouldn't overlook them and minimize them, but the, you know, what is at the root of all of this is that in this extreme polarization, on one side, the right side is far better positioned than we are. They have the kind of generative power that you can have because of the kind of massive investment over many years in radical right-wing think tanks that has occurred. So they can generate ideas. They can also take those ideas and move them directly to the mainstream because they have the distributive power of Fox News, One America Network, Newsmax, et cetera. And then finally, they have institutional power because they've won themselves a place at the center of one of our two major political parties. And so they're able to drive polarization far more effectively than we are, and are doing it in a way that is forcing us to have to respond to that polarization in some cases in ways that actually promote their own interests. You know, they create these boxes and they trap us in those boxes, rhetorical boxes, narrative boxes, and tactical boxes that when we respond inside the box, We were basically, you know, reacting to a provocation on their part to create the context in which they can further drive their message home with their base.
Mm-hmm. Let me just put the number out. This is a call-in show. We are already halfway through. So if you do want to get on the air and ask your question or make your comment to Scott Nakagawa, my guest, you can do that at 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. Please try to do it sooner rather than the last 5 minutes, which does tend to make things a little more difficult. So let's talk about the Democratic Party then, and its difficulty in making a strong response. Well, you've had a long career as an activist. You've had to interact with all kinds of people involved in all kinds of institutional settings and not. What's your take on what the Democratic Party has done wrong, and can we actually work within the Democratic Party to meet the kinds of challenges?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not going to write off the Democratic Party because we need them, you know, but we're in a situation here because we are in a two-party kind of system where there's a kind of political duopoly that we're having to contend with. And in that duopoly, one side, the Republican side, has a real plan for addressing this situation, as I said. You know, they have a very future-oriented looking plan that does rely on a lot of nostalgia, but doesn't end there. And, you know, nostalgia for them is merely a tactic for provoking that. The MAGA idea, for example, is just a tactic for their side. And then on the Democratic side, I think what you have is basically a big wall of no and the lack of a plan and future orientation, and that's really problematic. You know, we are in a time of major shifts. For instance, we've left the Holocene behind. You know, we need radical new measures to deal with life in the Anthropocene. But only one of the two parties is speaking directly to that with radical solutions, even if we understand from our side that those are not real solutions at all. So it's caused a tremendous amount of alienation on the part of people to the left of the party, and particularly the faction's best position to drive democratization. And those groups I think of as the ones who have historically been left out, whose fuller inclusion would create a more democratic opportunity and participation for everyone, because it would resolve problems of structural inequality that we have suffered from for far too long and that affect people really broadly, though certain groups most particularly, right? And so those factions are largely alienated from the Democratic Party, and that is really problematic. The Democratic Party is a problem party of liberalism at a time when liberalism is being challenged all over the world, and has become and democracy has now become a kind of proxy for it. So, you know, we should remember that 70% of the people of the world, according to the VDEM Institute, the Varieties of Democracy Institute in Gothenburg, Sweden, they're an international watchdog group. 70% of the people of the world live under autocratic governments. And that's up 16% over only 2 or 3 years ago. So, you know, they've gone so far as to describe the spread of autocracy as viral. Meanwhile, less than 14% of the people of the world live under liberal democracies, and only 4% live in countries that are growing more demographic. And they use that particular way of measuring people of the world who live under autocracies, because there are actually many countries that are growing in a more democratic direction, but they have very little influence on the international stage. And so they're really trying to help us to understand what's happening in the geopolitical balance of power. That can't but help but affect us here in the United States, because, you know, that is a bunch of leverage that human rights advocates and pro-democracy advocates don't have anymore. But, you know, so all of those things need to be taken into consideration at the same time as we try to understand what's happening now.
Mm-hmm. Well, with that, we do have our first caller online. Go ahead, John, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for the show. Very interesting guest. I'm glad to hear, Scott, what you've got to say. I'm going to quickly quote a couple of religious teachers, and then I will ask a quick question. Jesus said, the truth will set you free, and he also said, what is truth, while he was being interviewed before his execution. And then I'll quote, and then another quote from Jesus, in a rediscovered gospel, a more original one, or the original one, in Aramaic instead of Greek or whatever, he predicted the perversion of his teaching, and he said, I'll be crucified anew by what they do and say in my name.
Okay, John, just ask your question. We don't have a whole lot of time.
All right. I'm just going to quickly quote Krishnamurti. He said, you can't reform the system because the system will resist your reform efforts. All you can do is revolutionize yourself. I'm paraphrasing. And then my question is, the right has a huge advantage with its network of Christian associations, and the left doesn't have that advantage, and we will never have that advantage. So lies went out when a religion is so perverted as Christianity gets to dominate. How can we deal with the Christian advantage? That's my question. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a huge advantage to them that they have kind of faith-based factions, right? Because for those people, the cause that they are involved in goes beyond this lifetime. So they can make the kinds of commitments, the 24/7 kind of commitments necessary for a movement like this to reach critical mass and start to achieve the kinds of gains that it has achieved. And so, you know, I think that it's really important for us to think about progressive faith responses to that, to build networks among progressive faith institutions, and to recognize that the right-wing push within the evangelical community is one that is now increasingly alienating to some in that right-wing evangelical base. And so we need to look for all the fissures and cracks where they exist and try to exacerbate them in order to neutralize or immobilize certain factions and also get them at odds with one another, because I mean, I think there's a lot of material in place for that to happen. But we also need to be able to speak to alternatives, and that's something we haven't done very well. And so I would suggest that investment there is really important. The one last thing I'll say is that, you know, you referenced this thing about truth, the quote of Jesus. You know, the problem we're facing now is that fear does not recognize truth, right? Fear is just about reaction, and necessarily so. I mean, we can't spend a lot of time, if a bus is coming at us from, you know, like, and we're standing in the middle of the road contemplating what all of our options are, you simply react. And so it's a very natural human thing to react in that way when fearful, and the right has been really effective at making their people afraid. And so while truth may set us free, getting the truth to people is going to be increasingly hard.
And looks like we have Ben up next. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi. So the left has had this like issue with guns for so long, and I really see that at some point in time there's going to be a where it comes down to where it's going to be the right coming after us with their guns. So why, you know, why could we not embrace good, safe training and be ready? I mean, that's what many of us are doing. I'm actually going out and doing training this Saturday, and we're ready to fight. We are going to be we are kind of like the Ukraine, and we're not going to back down, and we're going to take them on, and we're going to take them on head to head with gunfire, and that's what's going to happen. I know it's coming down that far, but the left needs to really start embracing firearms more and not be so afraid of them. I know there's a lot of bad stuff that happens with them, but we're not crazy. We're not the ones out there doing crazy things with them. We can do it safely, and we can do it smartly and not have people get hurt other than the people that are coming after us. And that's pretty much all I had to say.
Thank you.
Well, you know, I'm not going to ever be the person who tells people they shouldn't defend themselves by the means that they think they should defend themselves. I'm never going to make a recommendation or stand in opposition to the choices that people make. I think that we should just keep in mind that, you know, the stakes here are extremely high, that the right-wing paramilitary base is extremely well-trained at its core, that they draw their membership from the ranks of military veterans and in some cases active duty military and former first responders. So, you know, they have the kind of background and training and the sort of cultural currency to be able to try to, you know, recruit people from the ranks of the military and law enforcement. And that's something that we should, you know, be really mindful of in this. In that we need to recognize that they have, in fact, you know, the kind of wherewithal to accomplish their goals far more than we have, and that I'm not sure the kind of training people can muster in the time that we have is going to be adequate. So we should also be looking for every alternative possible, you know, and remember that every confrontation that you're in is likely to rise to the level of violence possible. So if you're in a confrontation where you're holding a gun, you have to ask yourself, am I ready to shoot this person or be shot? Because having it will invite a situation like that more often than not. And so, you know, it's just a big question. It's one I had to ask myself back in the late 80s and early 90s when we were being faced with neo-Nazi skinheads in Portland, because at that period of time, those of us in opposition came under pretty substantive attack. The question for me was always, you know, this 16-year-old kid who's made this choice to belong to a neo-Nazi group and act out violently, do I want this to be what I reduce them to in the moment in which I have to defend myself against them with a gun? And I was just never able to resolve the dilemma that presented to me at a personal level, at a moral level, et cetera. But, you know, I'm not moralizing for everybody. I'm simply saying that was my decision-making process.
Those are wise words. And, yeah, you know, having gone to a number of the Proud Boy forget the name of the guy from Vancouver organizing here in Portland a lot. But anyway, they had a whole series of them. I'm sure there will be more. And I tried to actually talk to some of them. I guess I had a couple frustrations. One was those encounters tend to just spiral into a kind of mindless violence and just total polarization, shouting at each other, pepper spraying, bear spraying each other, sending fireworks at each other, which wasn't conducive to de-escalation. On the other hand, I actually tried to talk to some of them, and the ones I talked to were so thoroughly indoctrinated that the kind of conversations you could actually have in that situation were not the kind that would lead to. So yeah, I mean, that's just the situation we're in, and it gets mm-hmm. exacerbated by, you know, the kind of polarization at the grassroots level, fomented, as you rightly indicate, by the oligarchs and their minions. Anyway, I just mm-hmm. kind of wanted to flag that. Maybe you had something to say about that. But before we go to, I believe Mark is our next caller, I did want to, you brought up the Holocene, environmental mm-hmm. Destruction. And I did want to bring up what I think is a really important point I'll just read from an article. Buffalo suspect may be latest mass shooter motivated by eco-fascism. The suspected perpetrator of the deadly shooting in Buffalo, New York on Saturday may have been the latest mass killer to be motivated by a growing fixation of right-wingers, environmental degradation, the impact of overpopulation. Authorities believe the killer chose a suit. Well, anyway, they talk about, yeah, he obviously chose it because there's a sizable black community in that area, and his desire to kill as many blacks as possible and his belief in the great replacement theory. I mean, it's bitterly, tragically ironic that he chose the black community and he was so concerned about immigration, which is really, I think, is just one of the weirdnesses of that kind of thinking. But anyway, his manifesto said, "For too long, we have allowed the left to co-opt the environmentalist movement to serve their own needs." His manifesto states, "The left has controlled all discussion regarding environmental preservation while simultaneously presiding over the continued destruction of the natural environment itself through mass immigration and uncontrolled urbanization, whilst offering no true solution to either issue. I'll go along with the lack of offering a true solution to either issue, which is a parallel problem to what we're talking about in the Democratic Party's response to the subject we were initially talking about. But anyway, that's an issue I know you've been looking at. It seems to be with the climate situation spiraling out of control, the fact that the blaming Antifa for setting the forest fires that were going on, there's going to be a lot more of that kind of craziness, which seems very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's a real problem when things start to happen that you can't easily explain, which the Anthropocene will be full of if the scientists are warning us that the conditions ahead are right. And that with each step along the way, the problem escalates if we don't mitigate it, right? And so what we come to expect in 1 year could be totally irrelevant in the next year when bigger disasters can occur. And so, of course, the right is going to narrate all of those disasters in ways that are favorable to their agenda, and particularly keeping in mind that for the oligarchs at the top, the conversion from a natural resource-based energy strategy to not natural resource, but non-renewable energy resource strategy to a renewable one is unappealing at this point for some reason. All of those things need to be taken into consideration. But, I think that what's really important to try to keep our eyes on in this process is that, I said earlier, we're kind of at a paradigm shifting moment. Right, the end of the Holocene is one of the triggers for that, the mass migration that it's inspired. But it's also the end of this era is being rung in by globalization, and by kind of late stage capitalism, if you can follow me there. And so there's so many changes afoot, and the right has been very good at narrating those changes for their base. And in ways that really recognize something critically important here that I think that those of us on the left often forget, which is that all politics is identity politics, right? The United States was founded as a white supremacist nation. And since then, the arguments we've had about who gets to be an American and what does it mean to be American? What is our responsibility as Americans to ourselves and to the world have been framed by reactions to that original white supremacist scheme or arguments in support of it, right? I mean, that is basically the debate in the United States in terms of policy ultimately. That's what undergirds it. And the right really has recognized that and speaks directly to identity, remembering that identity stands on three legs. One is the story of me, who am I in the world, what makes me worthy, what keeps me safe, et cetera. And then it's who stands for me, who's the us, and what are they doing to make me feel honored and protected? And then who's against me, who's the they or them, right? And what are they doing that makes me feel threatened and afraid? In that triangle, the right has been very good at ginning up people's fears of the them, identifying who the them is, and then getting them afraid of them to the point where they will do almost anything in defense of their own perceived interests. And on our side, we need to not ignore that identity context, but instead start to try to understand it better and work through it in order to be able to build the kind of opposition we need.
Well, let's go to our possibly our last caller. We only have about maybe 6-7 minutes left. Mark, go ahead. You are on the air if you're still waiting.
Yes. Good morning. Thanks for a great program. I'm a frustrated German translator in a world of increasing concentrated wealth and narrowing debate and discussion, kind of a misanthropic world where debate and institutions are being emptied, and distrust, mistrust, cynicism are kind of exploding. Now, why can't the left win people to reduced working hours? Maybe a 3-day or 4-day, even someone suggested a 5-hour week. You know, so many jobs have been replaced by machines, by robots, by artificial technology. More jobs have been removed than have been created. People have discovered the wonder of working at home. I work for a language robot called DeepL.com, which helps with 26 languages, including Russian, Japanese, and Chinese. I can do more in 17 hours than in a whole year, and the translation is much better, you know. We're not living in an open world, open society that welcomes criticism and new ideas and learning from other cultures. This to me is the great challenge.
Okay, let's let Scott tackle that. Thanks, Mark.
Yes. Yeah, thanks, Mark. That was a great question. I think that you know, we should keep in mind that while it's really important for us to understand the role of race in the polarization that we're facing and in the rights' ability to have constituted the base that they have, it's not just race, but race is a trigger of many other things. So one of the kind of axes of polarization is between traditionalism and cosmopolitanism. And by cosmopolitanism, I mean those of us who believe that we should be good global citizens and live in a world and embrace all of the values that Mark just talked about. And so that polarization is one that's really hard to resolve, particularly in this context that you referenced, Paul, in which the Democratic Party is basically the champion of centrist interests at a time when all sides are rejecting the center, and that centrist interests is by far and away not the one we need to understand how to negotiate this much more diverse future. And so, excuse me. So I think that that's a, you know, it's a critical question. It's not an easy one to answer. But one thing that I think we need to do is keep our eyes and minds open. You know, we're getting to the end of the hour. And so I'll just say that, you know, at a time in history when we need prophets, we have many great critics, but few who are, you know, rolling out the kind of vision we need to embrace the future before us. You know, we are going to go through a tremendous amount of conflict and strife and potentially political violence. That's simply going to happen, is my belief. I don't think that we can prevent it, because we are in a paradigm shifting situation where various different kinds of things are up for grab, including serious amounts of power to define what that future could look like in a context in which few people have real answers. Visionaries are in a position to be able to claim the future. But, you know, because all bets are off and we no longer can rely on the norms and assumptions of the past, you know, there's a lot of confusion and people are being recruited to many different kinds of ideas. And so, you know, one of the things that the right has done is to convince them that those diverse people that Mark talked about are just takers who are a burden on the American economy versus makers who are their base, and engender resentment in that way. You can see that in the fight over critical race theory and the fight over LGBTQ inclusion, that they keep making these arguments that there's this burdensome class of takers and then makers here, and that seems to be the point of polarization they need to overcome you know, their kind of singularizing, totalizing view that only really speaks to the interests of one group among many. So you know, just keep your eyes on the future. Paul, you said earlier something about opportunity. I always think there's opportunity, and we need to be focused on opportunity. We can't just be against. We need to be for something, and it's time for us to try to figure what that is.
And on a final note, I know over the years, I know you've been in and out of Portland over the years, but the times you've been here, I'm sure you've relied on KBOO as one place to get your ideas out, and I can guarantee you that if there's a prophetic voice to come out from the diverse communities that KBOO represents, for example, it will come out over someplace, I believe, like KBOO rather than CNN, certainly not Fox News. So I just want to kind of reiterate the importance of KBOO. Maybe you have a last word about that.
Oh, yeah. I think that it's incredibly important. You know, I used to be a programmer on KBOO. Way back in the day, I had a show called Boneheads and Bigots Confronting the Politics.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, I mean, it was a great organizing tool for us. I mean, it really did work to help us to build our base and to get the word out and to, you know, and take charge of the polarization and figure out where we were going to drop that wedge. And so, you know, no other radio station, no other news outlet would have given us that platform. And KBOO was it. And, you know, I think that what we see now is, as democracy is shrinking, so are the spaces for democratic ideas. And places like KBOO are among those, you know, spaces for democratic ideas to be developed and flourish, for experiments to be conducted, for community being engaged. And KBOO particularly is important because it's not just that, it's also a hub. All of the different kinds of pro-democracy groups around Portland and Oregon, you know, like one way or another across paths with KBOO, rely on KBOO for news, for information, and for a kind of sense of a community that is bigger than any one organization in any one neighborhood in any one county in the state.
Thank you so much for that, Scott. And with that, we will urge you to go to kboo.fm and click on donate, or text 4432, text KBOO to 44321. Send us a check, please, to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Scott Nakagawa, thank you so much. It's been a really interesting conversation today.
Well, thanks for having me, Paul.
Okay.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, and KBOO.FM on the web. The time is 8:59 a.m. Next up is Fight the Empire. Thank you.